Welcome to the Philosophy and Theory panel. We have a number of written questions that were turned in earlier, and we will also be opening it up to questions from the floor. So we'll begin with some questions that we have already written out here from the audience. And if there are any follow-ups, we can deal with them as we go along. One question asks, if Austrianism is realist, is the most compatible legal philosophy legal realism, given its basis in a priori assumptions? Is it a natural law theory?
I think there are a few incorrect assumptions in that question. First of all, Austrian economics wouldn't imply any particular theory about philosophy of law. Second is, legal realism is not a natural law philosophy. Legal realism is the view that cases are really not decided according to legal principles, but by other things such as the personal views of judges. So legal realism is not a natural law theory at all. So I would say about that question reminds me of a comment that Morris Cohen once said in response to a student. He said, in the first place, you're wrong. In the second place, even if you were right, so what? It's just not correct.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay, the Austrians say we don't know how to measure, compare, or add utilities, therefore nobody can and never should try to. And that's in quotation marks, so I don't know if that's drawn from someone. Isn't that a sign of a complex in face of people who, although without scientific foundations, do these things, and everybody does it, to improve their odds in the real world? I'll take a first shot at that and then others. I don't think anyone does it. I don't think there are any units with which to measure utility, which is simply satisfaction. I think, as Mises stressed, satisfaction is an intensive magnitude, whereas things like feet and yards and units of weight are extensive. That is, they exist in the world of the objective world as opposed to the subjective world of each of us. So I don't think a unit of measure can be more than a plaything. Someone can, for their own sake, sort of assign utilities, but even that would be arbitrary. And say, I think a Paul McCartney concert, which I saw a few years ago, gave me 100 utils, and the Rob Stewart concert gave me 20 utils. Therefore, I like McCartney 5 times more than I like Stewart. I don't see how that improves my odds in any sort of choice or decision making in the real world, but I may have missed something. Anyone else want to? Yeah, Jeff.
And even if that could be done by an individual person, it wouldn't make interpersonal utility comparisons possible because we wouldn't have a common unit, right? I could make up my own unit of utils in my own mind, and Joe could have his in his mind, but we wouldn't have a shared unit because to have a shared unit, we'd have to have an extensive property that we could objectively examine and say, yeah, that's. That distance is a foot or whatever. So it wouldn't really solve problems that people have in mind when they talk about the measuring of utility.
Yeah. The one thing that comes to mind about somebody that's trying to measure this kind of thing would be there's a group of people we call neuroeconomists that try to look at brain chemistry and the like. And I guess there they could measure things like endorphins or what have you. But they're confusing, I guess, some kind of biological thing, endorphins, or even we could say pleasure, with utility, which are two very different things. Utility is really all about what I choose to do, right, that I find valuable, which may not necessarily be pleasurable. And so I think it's a confusion about what utility is and confusing with pleasure if you take that path.
If I might disagree slightly with my distinguished colleagues, I'm not sure exactly what the questioner had in mind, but this is sort of an epistemological issue or methodological issue. In other words, you know, there is a common sense way in which we do this kind of thing all the time, right? If I were the moderator of the panel and one of you asked a question, I might say, you know, I think Roger Garrison would really enjoy answering that question. I don't think Jeff Huebner would really want to answer it, so I'm going to give the microphone to Roger. We would say, that's idiotic. That's nonsensical. What we would say is that isn't any kind of a scientific statement. I mean, that's a purely intuitive, conjectural belief on my part. That statement, you know, the statement Garrison would enjoy answering the question more than Huebner would enjoy answering the question, doesn't have the same epistemological status as the statement that, you know, Garrison chose A when he could have chosen B, therefore A ranks higher on his value scale than B. So in a praxeological sense, of course, we can't make any kind of interpersonal comparisons. We can't measure utility. But, I mean, in a intuitive conjectural sense, we often have guideposts to acting in the real world. We sort of have these sorts of things in mind. They just aren't scientific statements.
Okay, is there any form of non-individual action that can be said to have qualitative differences with individual action? Is there any form of individual action that can be said to have non-individual action that can be said to have qualitative differences with individual action or from individual action? In other words, is there a whole that can act in some sense?
Is the person who asked the question present, just to clarify what
you're...
Nobody wants to own up to it?
You know, there's sort of terminological. I mean, there is such a thing as collective action if you mean how groups make decisions, voting procedures and so forth. That is an action in the Misesian sense of people acting. So maybe it's just a terminological issue.
Maybe. I mean, it's not clarified here.
Yeah.
Okay. Should simple hoarding of money be considered saving? Why or why not?
I think the answer or the opinion is mixed on that question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was the engineer.
So the question is, can hoarding, is that right?
Yes.
Can hoarding
should simple hoarding of money be considered saving? Yes.
Okay, I'm not sure what's packed into the simple part.
Yeah.
But, I would say yes, but I suspect some of my panelists would say no. That by holding, think of it this way. You go to work and you produce a bunch of junk. Well, it's not all junk. You produce stuff. You get paid for it. It's called income. And you spend part of it buying stuff, and the rest you don't spend. Maybe you just keep in the form of money. You might even keep that money for a good long time. Who knows? But in the interim, the stuff that you've produced but haven't consumed is available for other people, okay? And so I think that's the same. That's a similar thing to saving in the form of an interest-earning asset or a bond or something like that. It's very short-term. In fact, it's an undefined term precisely because it's cash. You can spend it at any time. But to the extent you don't spend it, you're foregoing goods that you could have consumed, allowing other people to consume them. Anybody else?
I would, I might make a distinction. Mises talks about plain saving, which he defines as the piling up of consumer goods for the future. But that doesn't mean that the consumer goods aren't always present goods. So you're just shifting them into the future. I think money, when you hold money, or if you increase your holding of money, because that's what hoarding is, everyone has to hold money to make any transactions, because the receipt of income isn't simultaneous with the purchase of a good. So just by the very fact that you exist and live and act in a monetary economy implies you're going to have to hold money. So hoarding means to hold a higher amount of money in relation to your income. But I would say in that case, money serves You could use the word saving. I'm not against using the word saving money, but it doesn't have the same import as saving certain goods or buying an interest-bearing asset. Because money is like, let's say, a fire extinguisher in your home. That is, you're not transferring its use into the future, as you would be with a pile of consumer goods. What you're doing is you are buying present security, okay, with that fire extinguisher. Or you know, some other thing that you'll always have at the ready, a flashlight in case of a hurricane or something. So I think saving money is more like that, if you want to call it saving money. That is, it's performing its services while it's sitting in your cash balances. And to take it one step further, you're always saving money, as I said before, if you are active in a market economy. Okay, it just simply means that you're holding a greater part of your income, or if you want to call it your wealth, in the form of money. That's all.
I think we need to keep in mind that the semantics is somewhat problematic in this whole area, but the analysis I think is pretty clear, and the analysis is that whatever we wish to call it, saving and investing, it's based upon our time preference and leads to the distribution of resources across the structure of production to combine, capital goods production, the capital structure for the production of consumer goods, whereas the money relation determines the purchasing power of money. And so whatever words we use to refer to holding money, whether we call it saving or not, we just have to keep in mind that the effect on this is not to change the distribution between consumption and saving and investing and the use of resources toward the building of a capital structure and eventually consumer goods, but it's to change the purchasing power of money. This would be the effect. And so, you know, semantically we have a difficulty here, but I think the analysis we agree on.
Thank you. Here's a question. As a New Yorker, I have a lot of socialist friends. Really? Who have no idea about what the heck they mean. How can I, or what is the best approach to, convert someone to the Austrian theory of economics? This is a question on strategy. Anyone want to? Yeah, I'll say a few words while Peter is collecting his thoughts. I once had a debate with Walter Block. Don't tell him that because he would want to re-debate it. He probably forgot it by now. But Walter Block's argument was that you do it by appealing to their passion for justice. For example, if you're talking to your classes, you appeal to directly to their passion for justice. That, you know, this is right and this is why it's right. I don't think that's the correct approach. I think the correct approach is to show how things do not work, how there are undesirable consequences, how there are things that they themselves would not want. So, in other words, you do it piecemeal. You do it by showing, look, we have these minimum wages. We've had them for a long time. What they do is they cause unemployment, especially among black teenagers, the precise group that they want to are intended to help the most. You show the problems with rent controls, for example, in New York City, and I teach in New York City. So I think you show them examples of where governments have failed and where government intervention has failed, where the free market is works. You know, you compare them to other areas. You know, Disneyland has much less, or Disney World has much less crime than, you know, downtown Los Angeles, or Disneyland, which is near Los Angeles, has less crime than you know, a public area in Los Angeles. You just point those things out. And then I think you can step by step draw them into interest in Austrian economics and then get them to begin viewing the world that way. Does anyone else? Yeah.
I mean, who could ever choose between Salerno and Block? So I think we ought to remain neutral on this question. But seriously, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, there is no uniquely there is no one right. approach. I mean, it depends on the circumstances. It depends on who you're talking to. Some people respond very well to the kind of consequentialist arguments that Joe is offering. Some other people respond well to, normative kind of arguments like Walter was presumably advocating. I think you just have to be opportunistic and, kind of think on your feet.
Go ahead. Wait. Chad said I had to do this.
So you referenced the difference between, your argument was that difference between Disneyland and downtown LA, and that's kind of an empirical argument. Where do you draw the line between trying to make an argument from a theoretical standpoint and another one citing statistics?
That's a very good point. You can't just make a completely empirical argument. I was talking in terms of teaching principles of economics. You can get across to by simple common sense, you can show that, if they're willing to follow you, that price controls cause surpluses or shortages. And then from there, with that one powerful tool, you can show how all of these empirical events make sense. So it's a very good question. It's a penetrating question. There has to be some theory, I would say. Does Immanuel Kant have a place within within the libertarian family? Does David Gordon have a place within the libertarian family?
Well, the second part is quite easy to answer. Obviously not. But, I think on the first part, there's certainly, if you talk about just Kant's philosophy of law, there's certainly libertarian aspects to it. It has a very strong view of individual rights, individual property rights. There's disputes to what extent he accepts welfare rights, but he doesn't accept them to the way they are now. There's a book, very good book by Arthur Ripstein I'd recommend on Kant's political philosophy, although he takes him a little bit too welfarist a manner. Now, of course, there's the argument the other way that Ayn Rand and her followers, especially Leonard Peikoff, have, that they think that Kant is an irrationalist, or as Rand called him, in one speech, a machine gunner of the mind, and they think really he's Kantian philosophy's undermining any sound basis for knowledge of reality. But I don't, I'm not persuaded that view is true. I think Peikoff has given some account of Kant, but I don't think there's much to it, or much to him for that matter.
Okay, just hold the microphone, David. Did Mises ever accept that man acts is only a local a priori? And then the second one, which we can all address, does Austrian economics eschew all empirical tests? I think Horwitz disputes that it does. Okay, so why don't you try to take a shot at the first one?
I think he thought that man acts is universally true. I mean, that's... it isn't that just some people act and some don't. I think in one of my lectures I spoke about local a priori. That was a priori concepts. That's referring to concepts that you need to understand a particular area of experience, such as you wouldn't be able to understand, say, people engaging in trade if you didn't have a concept of barter or money. But it doesn't follow from saying that there are local a priori concepts that the statement man acts is a local a priori. So I don't think Mises would have accepted that. And I think on place for, the second part was place of the empirical economics. Well, I think it depends, of course, how you want to characterize economics. I think Mises was just concerned to say there's a theoretical discipline part of economics that's just developing the concept of action. I mean, it doesn't rule out empirical work that one might call economics, but it's just he wants to make sure he have room for this theoretical place at all. I mean, just defining economics a certain way really doesn't matter all that much, I don't think.
Yeah, on the second part.
You want to read? Let me read that again. Okay. Does Austrian economics eschew all empirical tests? I think Horwitz disputes that it does.
I don't recall the specific Horwitz statement that the questioner might have in mind, but I mean, I think for me, the answer depends on what exactly you mean by empirical test. I mean, I think most Austrians eschew the traditional, if you mean sort of hypothesis testing, right, that the law of diminishing marginal utility is some kind of conjecture that must be tested against data or experiments, accept or reject the hypothesis. I think most Austrians would not be comfortable with that characterization. But if empirical test means using qualitative and quantitative information to apply Austrian theory to particular episodes, to the past, for example, if I want to know something about a business cycle, if I want to know something about the Great Recession starting in 2008 or the Depression or any historical episode, which involves looking at various kinds of data at different levels of aggregation, analyzing the data in different ways, even including using regression analysis or some kind of quantitative approach. I don't think I wouldn't rule that out ex ante as being somehow incompatible with Misesian praxeology. Now, that isn't to say that all kind of quantitative analysis is equally valid, but I don't think it's all inconsistent with Austrian economics when it's considered part of applied work or what Mises would have called doing economic history.
If you read Mises' book, Theory and History, you get the idea that theory and history are complements, okay? Mm-hmm. And what the mainstream profession means by when they say empirical work is just sort of a very narrow and stilted history of things that can be counted. And while it's true, it gives you a good feeling if your theory and your data are saying the same thing, okay, makes you feel good, you can't claim that one is the test of the other. Okay, if they're not saying the same thing, you need to look at your data, look at your empirical techniques, and you also need to look at the theory, you see, and see which one has a problem. Typically, the people that are very much bent on testing the theories with the data just assume that it's the data that's right, and if it doesn't pan out right, it's the theory that's wrong. It may be the data that's wrong. And yet you see even Chicago economists will occasionally recognize that. In other words, suppose you know you have a theory that suggests that a minimum wage will cause greater unemployment. But you find some data from Montana or somewhere that says the opposite. You say, oh, they had a minimum wage law and unemployment went down. Okay, now, does that data test the theory, or would you say the theory kind of tests the data? Even a Chicago economist will say, well, let's look a little more closely at that data. Might be wrong. Okay, so do all the testing you want, but make sure that you realize that each one is testing the other, and it's not a one-way relationship.
I do want to say, take something that Professor Klein said, a step further. I don't just think that Austrian theory is applicable to explaining the configuration of empirical data in the past. I actually think that it can also and should be, and it's always applied to explain what's going to happen in the future. So when we say that minimum wages create a surplus of labor, and we see a minimum wage that's raised, We do see that what follows from that. We do see that, in fact, what Hayek called a pattern prediction. That is that there are more people with low skills searching for jobs than there are available jobs. So that's one example. Another example I want to give is I have been doing some work on comparing Rothbard and Friedman as monetary economists. And from 2001, for every year, up through the day after he died, actually, it was a posthumous article in 2006, late November, Friedman said that the American economy was fine. In fact, in an interview in 2005, around Christmas, Friedman, who was still in possession of all his senses, he still was very sharp. He was on the Charlie Rose show, and he told Charlie Rose that American economy has never done better than it has done in the last 20 years, especially under Alan Greenspan. And he saw no problems with the American economy, and he thought that people that were claiming that, you know, there were bubbles and all this other stuff were doomsayers and so on. And then, of course, you know, in the fall of 2007, we had all these collapses. These collapses, the bursting of the financial bubble, of the housing bubble, first the housing bubble, then the financial bubble, they were all predicted. The pattern of the bursting of these bubbles were predicted, the pattern of the data as they would emerge in the future by, you know, people like Peter Schiff, our own Mark Thornton, a number of Austrian economists. I actually found an article in 2004 by myself in which I said that this was a housing bubble. I didn't actually, just recently, and that this was going to end, and fairly soon. So, well, we can't predict timing. We can predict patterns. And I went back and looked at that. Hayek made that statement in the 50s, about early 50s, about pattern prediction. But in the actual, earlier, in the early 1930s, in 1932, when Lionel Robbins published a very important essay on the nature and significance of economic science, he sets the whole thing out, and he says that you can make empirical predictions about future patterns of economic activity, where especially where you're judging the effects of government policy. So I think it's really the other way around, that the pure theory allows you to predict the empirical or the structure or configuration or pattern of the empirical data. Okay? It's exactly, they have it exactly upside down.
Yeah, can I make a similar point? Sure. Back in 1974, just before the gold became legal once again, have I got the year right?
76, I thought, but maybe 74.
Whenever it was.
Yeah.
Before it became legal, but right. It was set to become legal, Chicago economists were predicting that the price of gold would plummet. And the Austrian economists were predicting it headed the other direction. And it's just, that was a good test right there.
Yeah, Friedman and Machlup, both of whom were presidents of the American Economics Association, both predicted that gold would fall to approximately its industrial value, which was $10 an ounce. And that its link to the dollar was really what was holding up gold. It actually, of course, it exploded and it reached $800 per ounce by the end of the 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah. So here again, the Austrians were right about the pattern.
Let's think of the pre-assigned questions first. Unless you have something that's really...
Yeah, is it on this point?
It's kind of similar to the logic.
Okay, all right. Okay. Oh, okay. In theory, what would be the effect of having a 100% static money supply of a commodity money, such as if all unmined gold were to disappear... and this is primarily to Salerno, but I think Roger could also answer this because he's spoken about what a permanently and perfectly inelastic money supply, what that would imply for the economy. Do you want to take a shot at that, Roger?
No, I'll let you.
Oh, okay. No, I actually did not. Nobel Prize winner James Buchanan earlier in his career had written about what would happen if the money supply were dodo bones, a long extinct bird, so you could never reproduce it. What happens in a capitalist economy. I mean, if it's a free market, I think that as long as there's a sufficient amount technologically so that you don't have to exchange very small, minute amounts, what would occur is that we would have a gentle decline in prices as time went on. If it was 100% commodity money, you wouldn't have business cycles. You wouldn't have periods of boom followed by bust. And so as a result, what would happen is that the growth dynamic would be that the increase in capital would bring about more goods and services over time, and all supply curves would shift out more or less. We know that growth is non-neutral, which the mainstream doesn't take into account, and that certain sectors grow faster than others, but prices would tend to fall gently over time, as they tended to do in the 19th century. So I don't see any problem with that. Does anyone else want to get in on that? Okay. Okay, I was trying to avoid this, but there's a bunch of... all right.
Why then, if a totally constant amount of money, like kind of the perfect thing we are talking about, why are we like proponents of the gold standard, which is not increasing? So isn't there a better mechanism which really makes the money like
stay constant? Right. So the question here is, if a perfectly inelastic supply of money is the optimum, then why should we have gold, which increases over time? Well, I never said that, and Roger never said, and Buchanan never said that was the optimum. What I would say is that commodity money is the optimum, and every commodity in the economy, to the extent that it can be reproduced, is going to have changes in supply over time. I mean, there'll be technological advances, capital accumulation that will increase the amount of gold. I see no problem with that. That is having a it's probably pretty inelastic, the supply of gold, but it's not perfectly inelastic. So I don't think it introduces any problems. But Walter Block wrote a good article on this, saying that there's you know, any supply of gold is fine, but I think he misconstrued what Murray said. Murray would say that, and so would Ricardo, that any supply of gold is fine. Walter tried to say, well, that means that we have to have one type of a gold, you know, we have to have a fixed amount of gold. But that's not what that means. And Walter pointed out that the optimum is whatever the market decided, and he's right in his conclusion, but I don't think Murray would disagree with that, or von Mises would disagree with that. Do you want to?
Yeah, I'll just add one point. I would say the best way to think about this is we're talking about the dynamic of the market over time. So in the unhampered market economy, you would have a money, if it were a gold standard, that would be subject to production according to profitability. So if it were in limited supply and demand for money were rising because of greater productivity and other sorts of things, then the purchasing power of money itself would go up. It would make it more profitable to produce more money. And then entrepreneurs would decide how much money to produce, just like they decide how much of all other goods to produce. And that this would be then optimal, an optimal rule, if you will, for the production of money.
A small footnote to that. There's a great, Mises has a great line somewhere, and you guys, I forgot exactly where it is, where he says something like, you know, monetary calculation is not perfect, it's as good as it can be. In other words, the commodity that's chosen by the market is the best commodity, the commodity most suitable for economic calculation, but there are going to be errors. I mean, there will be small fluctuations in the supply of gold. Even if he had dodo bones, you know, maybe there are collectors of dodo bones who decide to increase their holdings for non-monetary uses. And, you know, it's like this notion of, a stable money or a stable price level. That's not the goal. I mean, the goal is to have the monetary system that is the best that it can be, given, you know, human imperfection, given that all commodities have some potential non-monetary use. So having something like the gold standard or whatever commodity the market has chosen, that's good enough and that's as good as it can be. It doesn't have to be perfect.
Okay, here's a very probing question. Hayek thought the pure logic of choice is only applied to the individual, and that economics becomes an empirical subject when more than one individual is considered. What line of reasoning led him to diverge from Mises on this issue?
Well, I'm not sure why Hayek thought that. I think he had in mind when he was talking about interactions between individuals, he had in mind a kind of empirical action between them. I think he was right that that can't be deduced. But I mean, when you're talking, I mean, I think he would admit you could certainly have deductive knowledge of various laws of exchange, and that would involve interpersonal actions. So I tend to think he's not that, when he was saying there's a limit on deductive reasoning, he had in mind something more empirical than Mises intended. I don't think there was that much difference between them. I mean, but I don't recall he ever said anything about that when I...
But he made that comment in the context of distinguishing his own view from Mises.
Yeah, yes, he thought, and he said later, he said he was surprised that he showed his article to Mises, and he said he'd intended his article to be critical of Mises, and he was surprised Mises liked it. But I tend to think that maybe he misunderstood the extent to which he differed from Mises, and that Mises had correctly interpreted what he said. It was like, you know, there's a story where two philosophers, one said, I think we're not disagreeing. I agree with what you say. And the other one said, well, I don't agree with that either. So I think we have a case around. I mean, it's not really clear exactly what Hayek, he didn't really say in detail what was the problem, but I tend to think there's not that much difference between them.
Maybe I should say to the panelists, get to ask questions too.
Sure.
I'm trampling on Gordon's territory here, but my understanding is that Hayek, of course, Mises was a prioris, pure and simple, but Hayek is on record, and I'm thinking specifically about a letter to Hutcheson, saying that he's never been an a priorist, and that this what was it, the 33 article or whatever, where he was trying to suggest to Mises that he's gone a different route, that he's not an a priorist, never has been. Is that true? Is that the way you see it? In other words, Hayek was never an a priorist.
Well, I think it's right that he didn't have an a priori theory of knowledge. He tended, I remember he said once, he said he thought a priori is really just, he thought that he really was doubtful about the whole category a priori, been influenced by Quine, who questioned that. But he thought that was consistent with accepting a pure logic of choice, at least on the individual level. He accepted that. He'd been influenced a lot in philosophy by Popper, who was his friend, who wouldn't... Some Popperians talk about an a priori, but they take it in some rather unusual way, so it's just conjectural. But I think it is right that Hayek didn't believe in the a priori, at least to the extent Mises did, although he did say, I mean, he was very influenced by Kant himself, but he took Kant in a rather different way from Mises.
It's important to keep this discussion in context, that while Hayek may have conceived, you know, he may have conceived of a different philosophic foundation for his theory of choice. His theory of choice was not that different from Mises, and Hayek was certainly no positivist in the modern sense. In fact, there's a great remark in the autobiographical book Hayek on Hayek, where Hayek says he says something like, you know, he's often asked why he didn't come out with a full-scale refutation of Keynes's general theory, and he has a number of reasons why he didn't think it was prudent to do that at the time, and he wishes that he had. But he said, I equally regret not having written a response to Friedman's Essays in Positive Economics, which in its own way is just as dangerous a book. That was the book where Hayek, where Friedman outlines his famous essay on positivism, which is sort of the Bible for almost all mainstream economists. And I would imagine when I was a grad student, and maybe it's true now, Friedman's 53 essay was on the required reading list for every sort of introductory economic theory course as the lone, you know, methodological reading. You know, well, this is sort of a common sense statement of what we all believe.
Let me just add to what Peter has said. This is a speculative hypothesis. Hayek learned his economics from one of the followers of Menger, Friedrich von Wieser, who believed very strongly in equilibrium, in general equilibrium, as sort of an optimal state. And Hayek always accepted that because Mises, even though he sat in Mises' seminar, Mises never really wrote out his essays on methodology until years 1928 to 1933. By then, Hayek had graduated, had been influenced by Wieser, had become an economist in his own right. So when he wrote his article, there was one in 1933 where he suggests this empirical element, and then 37, Economics and Knowledge, where he talks about it. Basically there, he really believed that all deduction could get you was some sort of a static equilibrium state. When Mises's book on Human Action came out, Mises showed that, in fact, if you use the action axiom, you already have uncertainty. That's an immediate implication. So you don't end up in some static state. You don't have to. You can end up with a fuller and richer view of human action. So Hayek wrote a review of it. He was basically, lauded the book and liked it, praised it. But he didn't absorb it at that point. He didn't quite understand what Mises was getting at. So I think there was some confusion there. Mises learned his economics, meanwhile, not from von Wieser, but from Bombaverk, who was much more like Menger and did not believe in general equilibrium. So they were thinking along different tracks, I think. Okay, we can stop here, and we have a 50-minute break, and you can either change and go to the other panel or come back here. We'll still be here. Thank you.